You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the small hours of November 14th, 1984. Lights blasted on in a vault room in seven segments from wall to center, revealing a chandelier-like display holding four different potion bottles, maroon, indigo, cerulean, and khaki. Duilio presented to Alexis III what he promised, believing that a man who dedicated his life to chemistry will find the concoctions before him more than useful. 9 out of every 10 oppressees stayed awake through the previous night, while the remaining 10th could only sleep briefly or unrestfully. In cabin E6, Kitty spent her sleepless night gazing at the gibbous moon, telling her father and Audria's mother that their murderers will pay. The sun rose to her, doubling down on the promise she made to herself that she'll get out, and so will every oppressee but the four from W1. Kitty couldn't unthink the moment Stanton, Poppy, Flossie, and Charlie bent the knee to the oppressors by shooting the kids from E18, even if it didn't shock her because of how close to home it hit her. Cabin W15 was where Audria let Elmiria try to sleep on her lap, feeling her psyche stick back together like bricks being laid with kitty glue. Isaias asked Kitty if it was too late for the two of them to talk, getting told that it surely wasn't, with a smiling look back. She asked him if he wants to escape the hellhole they're in, and he said that was what he wanted to talk to her about, but didn't know how to go about it. Kitty explained that the oppressees must all be united, or most of them, at least as numbers were all they had, but did hold out hope that an attack from the outside will make such a resistance unnecessary. A marching approach from outside hatched Sheridan and Willa out of their sleeps as Sonsoles and Clement noticed a second one nearing them. Duilio's guards bulldozed into W15 and E6 at roughly the same time, scaring W14, W16, E5, and E7 into watching on. Kitty was told to stay where she was, while Isaias, Sonsoles, and Clement were informed that an exceptional man would like to see them at once. Audria, Sheridan, and Willa had lasers pointed at their hearts and were advised not to interfere as Elmiria learned that someone she knew well requested her presence before him. Isaias, Sonsoles, and Clement panicked when the guards body slammed them, cuffed them by their elbows, dragged them outside, and fired warning shots that quieted them. Elmiria held onto Audria for dear life as she was pulled from her arms, resisting hysterically from the initial grab to her first step on the parking area where she joined the other detainees. It was a miracle that her hysteria wasn't met with any gunfire, but she'd find out why the guards who took her away showed such restraint in time, and it'll set Camp Sunshine off. Founded in 1935 by Alexis Sr., Alexisville State University would have celebrated its 50th anniversary the following autumn. But now the campus joined countless other public spaces in whistling a quiet, underscoring the quick sureness of Gregorio Jr.'s lockdown. It sat before and snaked around trees, rocks, and brush that encircled a small rock-forming waterfall and surrounding meadow quad. On a hill in name only, the university's science building was one of its oldest and best maintained, shedding one paint chip a day, if that. Standing front and center in a chemistry classroom, Alexis III looked around with a smile that wished it was still the summer he taught at the university. He remembered the class he taught consisting of 28 eighth graders from 7 municipalities and 3 provinces, Isaías, Sonsoles, Clement, and Elmira being 4 of those students. Hardening his left-handed grip on his suitcase, Alexis III was looking forward to seeing his ex-students again. He promised Gregorio that if his desired reunion was allowed to happen, it'll yield the most riveting, recreational, and fruitful returns imaginable. When a repurposed delivery truck arrived, the camp's guards handed Isaías, Sonsoles, Clement, and Elmira over to the yellow-crossed militants operating it. Alexis slapped his suitcase on the teacher's desk, stared into locketed pictures of Gabino Jr. and Lyndon, and wished that their endeavors farewell. Isaías, Sonsoles, Clement, and Elmira were heaved into the back of the truck like full garbage bags coming to from the impacts as their sickening transport began. Winding roads and those of varying elevations rocked them in all directions as the troops riding with them remained ready to shoot. Elmira deeply breathed in and out, her aim to give the finger to anything this so-called exceptional man tries to feed her by force. Sonsoles' sole loyalty was to herself and won't let some block-bodied cacodemon turn her into another one of his lemmings. Isaías let his eagerness to get smarter numb away the drowning pangs striking out of his detainment. The hurt Clement absorbed from being detained was less severe than his difficulty in imagining the hell unfolding back at camp without shedding tears. When he lost the fight to not cry, his sorrow could only push out 2 teary whimpers before the truck stopped. Troops dragged him, Sonsoles, Clement, and Elmira outside and manhandled them into standing beside 24 other kids. Isaías noticed how familiar his fellow detainees looked, but when he discovered that he was at Alexisville State University, he had a good idea who this exceptional man may be. That suspicion was confirmed when he and the other 27 were seated before a happily quivery Alexis in his former classroom. Even though no troops were in the room, everybody inside knew the outside was covered in armed people who'd kill minors and not shed a tear afterwards. Alexis could tell that his former students weren't expecting to see him again, let alone him wearing the ruthless regality that defined the Yellow Cross. He told them not to question him about how a son of Alexis Jr.'s could possibly join Gregorio, as that was currently none of their concern. Alexis asked his students to raise their hands if they knew all about the potions Sajonia concocted when she was alive, and they all did to his gladness. At the same time at Camp Sunshine, Duilio summoned all but 4 of the remaining oppressees to the auditorium for an assembly where he'll address the recent detainments and transport. Stanton, Poppy, Flossie, and Charlie weren't present, and neither were Erasmo, Basilia, Olvin, or Yailin on the prowl for scores to settle. Duilio started by telling his oppressees to not look at what transpired this morning as an isolated incident, because more detainments and transports will occur in the coming days, months, and years. He said the reason Isaías, Sonsoles, Clement, and Elmiria were the first to be detained and transported was due to their files being atop the pile. As Duilio was speaking, Gregorio's appointees at the Vital Statistics Register of Bromelia were hard at work checking the backgrounds of every Bromelian citizen and person living in Bromelia, and at the helm of this was Gabino Jr., a lifer of the agency who was now its director. When Grimsby Sr. was president, the 1980 convey occurred and it compelled the population to answer some very personal questions. It didn't allow any adult or child to leave anything unanswered, preferring half-budded responses over none at all. Threats of fines and imprisonment were made against anyone who defied the convey in any way. Gabino's endless assembly line of workers ceaselessly looked through the files of one citizen or resident after another, not caring about how much the populace had changed in the years after the convey. All that mattered to him was how the information could be weaponized against allies and enemies of the regime. Gabino instructed his workers to pay particular attention to the files of all residents from East Dominica and every citizen residing there. He was sure that Lyndon and his sister Yarrow would appreciate that emphasis very much given their history with that nation. Gabino could see the Yellow Cross staking their flag into the soil of East Dominica's capital city of Josephton, waving before a scatter of enemy corpses. But what he yearned to do more than anything was to get revenge on Roy Sr. and Sinclair for persuading Gabino Sr. to not give him a penny of his fortune days before his passing, bar him from attending his funeral, and turning his own family against him. Gabino Jr. had no idea where his brothers were, but believed that he'll get them sooner or later and will finish them once and for all when he does. He ordered that a D minor from the cusp of the 20th century be played for his worker jackets to open, read, and analyze to. At the university, Alexis wanted to give his former students a refresher on how various potions are made and what's needed to make each one of them. He had them open up all the windows that could be opened and asked that they turn on the air conditioning under threat of dire consequences. Alexis made his students wait an hour for fresh air to flow in and out of the classroom like blood cells moving through blood vessels. After that wait, he and they got suited up, thick gloves, gas masks, and all, allowing the seriousness of what was about to start to sink in. Alexis repressed his nervousness as he took a glass jar with a cube of lead in it out of his suitcase and screwed off its cap. Many of his ex-students were fully cognizant of how dangerous the potions were, having read countless stories of how they've torn whole communities to shreds. Alexis said that every one of Sajonia's creations began with lead, staring at his cube as if it was a jewel too beautiful for him to quit marveling at. Deeming it unnecessary to dwell on the metal's toxic effects on the body, he moved on to his next ingredient, taking out a bottle of this Vilebon, an ignoble gas that could melt metal on contact. Alexis sprayed it on the cube like an aerosol spray until it desolidified into a blue-gray sludgy blob. He assumed his ex-students noticed the color that the late cube had changed to, saying that the best parts were still to come. Alexis took out and ripped open a roll of coins made of Ferdinandium, poured them into the jar, and sprayed them with this vile bond too, creating a partly solid blob he made watery with liquid hydrogen and oxygen. He said that if he deemed it finished now, it would be little more than a poison, adding that one more ingredient was needed. Alexis took out another tiny bottle, and it contained the liquefied brain matter of a sheep that succumbed to Scrapie. He poured the substance into the jar, saying that with it and everything else mixed together, a potion capable of halting the harmful effects of others could now be born. The Cerulean Potion. Elmeria didn't get why Alexis would teach her and her ex-classmates how to concoct something that could treat people. She thought that all the Yellowcrossers knew how to do was hurt, having witnessed several of their marches down barge ins and pile-ons. Sonsoles was asked by Alexis if she'd like to say something since her hand was up, but she forgot what she was going to say, irking her into mumbling a grudging nay. Clement stood up and demanded that the whole class be told why they're together again and what purpose was this unwanted reunion going to serve. Isaias seconded that demand, told Alexis that no one was afraid of him, and threatened to pull a cabin E18 if he didn't answer right then and there. Sonsoles yelled that she and the other ex-classmates will gladly help him with that pull and see to it that it prevails. Alexis screamed for his ex-students to be silent and shot a bullet into the ceiling with his pistol. The abrupt loudness of that shot and subsequent reverb handed him the affrighted mass bending of the knees he smiled his anger at. Alexis yelled that he was the teacher and the detainees were the students, and that only he could demand, threatening to have them put in Deontown or someplace worse if they ever stood up to him again. He asked himself where he was in his lecture and answered that he had three other things to reveal: bottles of maroon, indigo, and khaki potion. His ex-students juggled, having the stool scared out of them by his threat, with their hair raising over what he may do to them. Alexis said that by now, his ex-students should know what the maroon and indigo potions do, as their summer together looked into them in great detail. Sonsoles feared that he had plans to use the concoctions on her and her former classmates, a fear made rational by the morning he injected white into two of her peers and teal seconds after looking at that cousinly pair as if they were nutcases with springs that could pop at any moment. Alexis hoped his ex-students had a good enough understanding of what the Cerulean was all about, because he's moving on to the khaki potion. He took out a second jar, repeated the lead, this vile bond, Ferdinandium, hydrogen, and oxygen steps as lust made his heart race. Alexis told his ex-students not to feel bad that he won't be adding the matter that made the Cerulean whole in this brew, but promised to recompense that exclusion. He poured potassium iodide onto the new watery mix and wadaliase, a chemical found in the milky sap of death cover trees. With those additions, the brew turned khaki, creating a potion with the ability to expel all impurities from the human body. Alexis said that with the concoctions he made before the reunion and the two produced during it the M, I, C, and K of his project will come to be. He confessed to having his ex-students brought to him for the purpose of creating a legion of potion makers like the one Sajonia led, one of many under a banner his superiors called Operation Mick. Alexis said while the maroon, indigo, cerulean, and khaki potions were the focus of said operation, that didn't mean the others weren't worth focusing on. He added that brews such as the teal, white, and brown had their own operations progressing side by side with Operation Mick projects his ex-students may take part in later or very soon. Sonsoles yelled that there was no way she or her ex-classmates would involve themselves in something so fiendish. Clement asked Alexis if he or those above him ever thought of the possibility that the potions could end the world as they knew it. Isaias exclaimed that if his memory was correct, the concoctions didn't discriminate in who and or what they affected, calling the massacre at Amephrater an excellent example of that. Alexis found it insulting that some teenager would bark at him like he was a basic trainee who could do nothing but make mischief and cause mayhem. He fired a bullet into Isaias's desk, blowing burnt lead fragments, sharp metal chips, flying splinters, and wooden dust all over him. Alexis was hopeful that the agony his shot caused will smarten him into respecting him and serve as a horrid warning that'll be taken seriously. He walked up to Sonsoles and made her stand by grabbing her chin, saying that it wasn't necessary to unmask her to see how pretty she was. Alexis never forgot about the sweet apple she gave him before his first class began, calling it the best one he ever had. He could tell that Sonsoles was a true charmer, recalling how she charmed Clement and Isaias into getting along even though they hated each other's guts. Alexis reminded his ex-students that the guards will pounce if so much as a foot steps outside the classroom. Clement remembered catching him make out with Sonsoles sitting under the window he saw it through to ask God to give him strength. He wasn't fooled by how consensual the kissing looked, knowing that her compliance stemmed from a fear of what Alexis would do if she resisted. Clement felt horrible that he couldn't intervene without making himself a target or endangering Sonsoles, heaven forbid, choosing to keep in what he saw. Isaias' eyes widened when an acrid metallic smell slapped his nose. Then he found that Alexis's gunshot riddled his suit and gloves by the pinprick. His head started to get very heavy and feel as though someone was poking his brain with their razor-sharp fingernails. Alexis told Sonsoles that they were more alike than she would admit, remembering when he had two girls fighting to win his love when he was her age. Never had a morning gone by without their names singing in his head like hummingbirds, Chantel and Rafaela, two girls who grew to love him but hate one another. Alexis conceded that those songs were from the past, as the sisters presently had nothing in common with their former selves. He blamed the Marxists for adulterating them into images they'd proudly call their own, but said that what Chantel and Rafaela did for him will never die. Alexis III declared his love for Sonsoles, called her the one to make Alexis IV come to life, and said that he'd be darned if that destiny was denied its right to bloom like a tulip at the start of spring. That made Clement most of his female ex-classmates and many of the males sick, as that reminded them of the violations committed in the fog of the initial massacres. Most knew or had heard of the kind of man Alexis Jr. was, and were now sure that Alexis III desired to continue his father's tradition of spreading himself worldwide. The ex-students were also certain that their lives were in peril, seeing that danger unfold with Isaías clutching his forehead and belly as he fell off his seat. Asked about what he just did by Elmira, Alexis explained how Clement's romantic rival was reacting to an interaction between the cerulean and khaki potions. He said that when used correctly and singly, the brews were literal saviors. He kidded them not, halting or flushing without flaw. But Alexis preferred that the consequences of the potions' misuse be left for them to find out, intending to give them the privilege of such a sight and feel. He ordered his ex-students to remove their gas masks and goggles so that they could learn what making the mistake Isaías made was like. Alexis's laughy smile fell to a humorless frown when his order was defied, prompting him to repeat it, and snarled when defiance met it again. He said that as his ex-students knew, there were guards outside who'd step on the rebellion and them like bugs on the asphalt. The indifference Alexis saw all over their faces told him that all bets were off, making him threaten to have them hold up like cheese by lead. He said he had no qualms about ordering the guards to exterminate his ex-students the way he'd have Habsburgo V's pawns done away with, giving them 5 seconds to comply or have their lives expire. Alexis counted down to zero and was about to yell out his deadly order when every fire alarm on campus went off at the same time. That jolted him and nearly knocked him off his feet, but planted a seed of hope in the minds of his ex-students, telling them that a free future was possible, but scorned him for thinking he was untouchable. Black Hornets stormed the university and caught the Yellow Jackets by surprise, defeating their foes and taking control of the campus the dusk after the following one. One of the soldiers declared that as of 4:42 p.m. on November 16, 1984, the northernmost third of Alexisville was free, and that the two to its south will too be liberated soon. She and her number two led the Hornets to the science building and were shocked to see it in ruins, fearing the worst as they approached it with silent caution. Stepping onto what was left of the classroom, they found all 28 of Alexis's ex-students resting unhurt, with their suits soaked but still fully on. The lead soldier and her number two unmasked, grinning in relief as they revealed themselves as Chantel and Rafaela. Sonsoles awoke, spent a moment coming to from falling unconscious, and jolted her scoop back when she saw the two women. Chantel implored her to not be afraid, for the Yellow Cross can't hurt her anymore, vowing to make sure they're never able to again. Sonsoles felt every ounce of fear leave her body more certainly than the flush of a toilet. Standing up with the help of the hand Rafaela extended to her, Chantel noticed Elmira and Clement waking up, identifying herself and her sister as part of a resistance that'll make itself known to all soon. Before Sonsoles could ask, Rafaela assured her that Habsburgo had nothing to do with what she was a part of, calling him an absentee leader who was more interested in himself than his own country. Elmira followed in O'Reilly with an ask if by resistance Chantel and her sister meant the one that Gregorio was at the helm of. Rafaela swore on the Bible that neither she nor her comrades had any association with the Yellow Cross or its allies, having bore witness to their savagery in the seconds and hours following Habsburgo's re-election victory. Chantel sternly told Sonsoles, Elmira, and Clement that time wasn't on their side, saying that now wasn't the moment for endless questions. Rafaela added that they and the other ex-students need to be tended to medically at once, paying special attention to Isaías as she had yet to see him move. Chantel checked for a pulse and was terrified to not sense one, begging Sonsoles, Elmira, and Clement to tell her what happened in the classroom. Rafaela acquired her sister's peaking anxiety when an answer didn't come, making her fear that the ex-students were made to forget what was done to them. Rafaela saw two shattered jars and cerulean and khaki splattered all over the table, spelling out to her what was afflicting Isaías. She injected a greenish-yellow substance into his right common carotid artery, restarting his body the way a computer would boot up. Isaías woke up and hyperventilated as if he spent several minutes holding his breath while deep underwater. Chantel's medical troops decontaminated the late building with a white spray, wasting no time transporting the ex-students to the university's hospital. It took 10 days to treat the 28 and another 6 to make sure they showed no lingering symptoms or signs of chronic illness. Once the ex-students were cleared medically, Rafaela sat them down in the hospital's unscathed church while Chantel asked that they tell her who hurt them. The story that the sisters would hear infuriated them into searching the whole campus for Alexis as if they'd never left the battlefield. Chantel and Rafaela found no trace of him until they entered a forest northeast of campus, discovering a bunker with its door open. The sisters furiously led their soldiers inside and screamed for Alexis to quit hiding like a coward and come out so that he could face what he did. But 11 hasty stomps into the bunker, Chantel found that it was a maze with only an entrance, galling her into splitting her soldiers into multiple groups of 2, 3, or 4. That was done to make sure Alexis couldn't slip through any cracks or take out her whole squad in the event of an ambush. Rafaela and the trio with her broke into a small room that had a collage of monochrome photos glued to its walls. One picture was of her, Chantel, and Alexis as high schoolers, smiling to show off their pearly white teeth while having their arms around one another. Another was of the sisters fighting at the center of a crowd as he watched on with a smile that enjoyed the fact that the girls would do anything to win him over. A third picture was of Alexis smiling as Chantel and Rafaela grinned at him while looking at each other as if they were prepared for a rematch. Concomitantly, a quartet neither sister led made a grim find. An office cluttered with bloodstained photos of university students and faculty. Chantel and the woman with her came across their fourth dead end in 8 minutes, but this one had something that made them shiver. That thing was a wall-sized picture of what would have been Alexisville State University's class of 1985, haunting her soldier with memories of seeing her fellow would-be graduates get murdered or kidnapped. Since the attackers wore ski masks, the woman could only identify them by voice, and one stuck out like a sore thumb, that of Luisa, then a political science professor. Being under Chantel's authority, Isabella never thought that someone whom she looked at as a mentor and friend would even participate in the massacres, let alone direct one of them. Rafaela was teary and hot pink in the face as she ripped up the photo of her fighting her sister like it was a monster she wanted to make go away. The trio was caught between watching on in commiseration and scanning their senses for any threats in the air or afoot. The more photos Rafaela saw of herself and Chantel with Alexis, the hotter the pink on her face got, soaking her in sweat as she kneeled and whimpered. Isabella told Luisa that she better hope they never meet again because there was no respect or admiration between them anymore. Sonsoles, Clement, Isaias, and Elmuria made themselves at home in the dorm rooms they would have moved into for the 1985-1986 school year, relaxing under the stress of not knowing what was going on back in Camp Sunshine. Their concern stemmed from how sure they were that Duilio and his cronies will spare no expense in reobtaining them and ensuring that they're never freed again. That diverted their minds away from what was befalling the oppressees at Camp Sunshine and those elsewhere in Bromelia in response to their liberation. Elmuria watched Pruss Blue Robins go about their afternoon in their nest atop a tree, telling them to treat every second of their peace like it was their last. Isaias took a walk around campus, but his near-death experience left him moving like an old man, but he didn't let that bother him as he believed that he'll be his old self again in due time. During his second lap, he saw Clement sitting on a bench reading a book and avoided having to interact with him by turning and walking back to the dorms. The last thing Isaias needed was to get into yet another fight with his romantic rival, catching Sonsoles playing pool by herself and looking at him like she didn't want him in her presence. After hours of searching and barging, Chantel, Rafaela, and their soldiers were finally at the bunker's centermost room, ordering Alexis to surrender or be killed. They stormed in when no answer was given and saw an empty office with a desk that had a tape recorder sitting on it like a book. Despite finding this odd, Chantel decided to press play even as those under her weren't so sure that was a good idea but remained ready to engage. Alexis greeted listeners and said that if they were listening to this recording, then the Yellow Cross no longer had Alexisville State University. He called that a grave pity and conceded that such a loss would be looked at by many as an indelible dent to the iron on Gregorio's fist. Alexis assured listeners that his dear, dear leader was much, 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 much more formidable than what he proved to be in the last several days. He said that the Marxists listening may think they've won, but in reality, the people on Gregorio's side were the true winners. Alexis told listeners to enjoy the upper hand they have over the Yellow Cross, for they'll pay back that glory with interest and won't know when the day or night to repay will come. He admitted to having no idea who the frauds pretending to be liberators were, but said that their act and day will die and burn. Chantel paused the recording and said that when the Yellow Crossers return, she and her soldiers will be more than ready to vanquish them again. Rafaela added that the kindly leader she and her sister were fighting for will reveal himself to the nation soon, and it'll begin the Yellow Cross's walk to a disaster it won't be able to get up from. Chantel declared herself and her comrades prepared for and able to persevere through whatever horrors and depravities Gregorio had in mind for them. At the Ferdi Luxor suites and penthouses, Alexis gazed at the wilderness from his penthouse with a smile, admiring how beautifully his plan was coming together. He told his ex-students to mark his words that they will reunite again, and when that happens, they'll forever be his. Then he heard his telegraph print out an urgent bulletin about Crisanto Coast being under attack. Alexis tried to constrict his whiskey on the rocks into breaking, and when he couldn't, he threw it at the floor, shattering it near his black loafered feet. He asked himself how the devil Gregorio's troops weren't able to prevent that attack from commencing, calling this possibly the second time in so many days that he's had to run because of an offensive from what he assumed were the same frauds that stole Alexisville State University. Alexis wanted to tell the Yellow Cross leadership to do something that'll traumatize the liberal rebels and their herds of followers. Suddenly, another bulletin printed out, and it was from Duilio requesting that he come back to Camp Sunshine as soon as possible. That made Alexis grin daggers at the improbability of him evading the nearing battle in time, but then the fighting stopped as abruptly as it started. He ran down to the lobby as it was announced that an attack on their community had been thwarted, getting out of him a laugh, eager to see Marx's blood spill. Remembering Duilio's message, Alexis returned to his penthouse, got his suitcase, and traveled opposite to where everyone else was going. A 1984 calendar hung on the wall of Cabin A1's main office, having the fourth day circled on its December page as the three before it were that and X'd off. Ladislao and Isaura were up to their necks in paperwork they helped Duilio do as Erasma and Rayen went over the material that Aurelio and Tecla were to present as Nicanor intently frowned on. Watching the Camp Sunshine welcome sign near, Alexis thought about the bottles of maroon, indigo, cerulean, and khaki he was given during his last visit. He didn't know what Duilio had for him this time around, but expected to be at the camp for a longer period of time, and for that stay to be a lot more interesting. When his ride parked to an end, so did another, and Erasmo, Basilia, Olvina and Yaelina led Stanton, Poppy, Flossie, and Charlie out of it. Alexis started getting ideas as to what his second visit will be like, smiling at the lip licks he could tell were brewing in the eight. In addition to the mentioned potions, his suitcase also contained a writ inviting him to a big conference that'll take place on December 20th. And as fate would have it, Alexis's time at Camp Sunshine will unearth the consequences of Alexisville State University's liberation and a few of those stemming from Gabino's mass file look-throughs. And that was M.I.C. and K. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.